Welcome to Metacast. I'm Josh Anderson.
And I'm Bob Galen.
Today's topic is going to be retrospectives. We have a bit of an abbreviated timeline, so we're going to be a bit shorter than our normal 50-ish minutes, but we're going to try and give retrospectives their fair shake today.
That sounds good, Josh. Well, I mean, and we shouldn't really short shrift it. It's one of the more important sort of ceremonies of Agile and Scrum is the notion of a retrospective. We actually got someone who sent us an email, a comment, was looking for more information on retrospectives, so how to do them well. So for that person out there, that requester, who will remain nameless, this Metacast is for you, amongst other folks. So, Josh, why don't you kick us off? What do you think? Retrospectives.
So I think the first and most important thing is to do them, right? There's a lot of folks and companies that don't do them or do them for a week or two and they don't go anywhere and they quickly abandon ship. And that's really where this topic comes from, is that it's harder than people think to get these done and get these done right and to not have them become stale and really drive the continuous improvement angle that Agile's looking for. So I think right out of the gate, everybody's going to start with kind of the classic three questions of what did we do good, what did we do bad, and what should we try? Things like that. Like, I know that's how when you came into our org, that's the first thing that you threw at it.
I think I almost regret that sometimes, too, because I see it's not so much contradicting you a little bit, but it's not so much I think that people stop doing them, but to your point, they do them artificially. They do them flatly. They don't do them. They just get into this by rote tempo. Where they just, okay, now it's the end of the sprint, and we're going to go into and we're going to do a retrospective. And then, oh, by the way, they start following the same tempo, like the same three questions over and over again. And they really don't put their... So I've seen that pattern. Maybe we could talk about anti-patterns to drive into, like, what are good things to do. So one anti-pattern is, like, by rote retrospectives, right, where people just blindly follow the questions, and then it loses its value very quickly. They're not driving change with it. I've seen that a lot. I think sometimes the questions, not that they're bad, but maybe varying how you approach the retrospective would be good.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's a classic key for me that kind of shakes things up a little bit, because people do get in that rut, I guess you would say, where it's like, okay, same three questions, and you get the same three answers, and then even more concerning, you get the same non-action, right? You get people that get in the room, they put these things up on the wall, and maybe it's the same five things, and it's the same five things the next sprint, same five things the next sprint, and people don't do anything with it.
Well, there's another anti-pattern.
Right.
Is people, the teams themselves, they don't do anything with the results. They don't own the results of the retrospective. Sometimes I find that people want to, like in traditional project management, you make a list and you put it on, you know, you archive it. And they think that the very act of making the list
right.
guarantees that you're going to take action on those things. So a lot of time in retrospectives, you know, folks are like, you know, they're focusing on, oh, let's put it on the wiki. But it misses the commitment, right? And you can start reviewing. One pattern that's good is reviewing your last, you know, starting your retrospective by reviewing your results of your last one, right?
Yep.
Have we done anything about it?
Yeah, exactly.
So that's a little bit of a twist, maybe on a healthy pattern, that at least you can shake people up and you can make them realize that they haven't done anything about it. But I've seen that a lot as well. It was funny. I think I said this in the last Metacast. I was doing a training session or an open Q&A at my company for any Agile questions whatsoever. And this poor engineer in the back of the room raised his hand. And he was like, you know what, you know, we really don't, the retrospectives are really ineffective, and we really don't pay much attention, you know, to the results of the retrospective. What are you going to do about that? So confronting me about it, and you know my style,
yep.
Right? So there was a mirror, there was instantaneously a mirror that came up, and I shone his face in it. And I'm like, no, it's not my job at all. Or they were whining about the Scrum Master or whatever, and the Scrum Master can facilitate that. But, I mean, the core thing for me is they miss the boat. You know, if they're boring, then the team should do something about it. If they're non-impactful, the team should do something about it. Do you agree, disagree?
Absolutely. I've had the same questions, or I've had the same things where folks say, we want to stop doing the retrospectives. And it's like you can see it coming. You say, why? I say, well, because we don't get anything out of it. I say, well, why aren't you getting anything out of it? I say, well, it's the same, you know, 5 points that come up. I'm like, so what have you done about those 5 points? You know, the retrospective is only as good as your willingness to take action upon those items. Because if you just put that time in there and don't do anything about it, then you're wasting time. And you're not attempting to even get better. Like, you're not even trying to get better. You know, I'm okay if we get those same 5 items in 6 retrospectives in a row, but in each one, they say, well, we tried that. That didn't work. We're going to try something else. And they keep trying to beat it to death. And eventually, they're going to get it knocked down.
It is. It's one of those aspects, I think, to Agile that people miss is the continuous improvement aspect. You can do it maybe in velocity. There's some things that during the course of the day, you know, as you're working, like unit tests, maybe in constant continuous improvement, you would do more unit tests or you would continue to do that. I think the activities, the day-to-day work activities people get. But when it comes to reflection and then handling, like, bigger things, the teams just sort of, like, pull back from that, and they don't want to take personal ownership. The other anti-pattern is looking around and trying to putting that monkey on the back of other folks.
Yeah.
So I hear a lot, and again, some impediments I do own as a leader or a scrum master, but a lot of times folks are trying to give me impediments, and I think to myself, well, gosh, this is perfectly in your purview. In fact, it's better in your purview to make a change than it is to put it on my back. So they're constantly looking for, like, a get-out-of-jail-free card, I think, for retros as well. Do you think it's laziness? What is the root? Do you have any thoughts about the root cause? Is it because it's hard? Is it laziness? Is it just not buying into Agile? Because one of the roots of the tenets is always getting better.
Like, yeah, I think it's usually a combination of all of those things. I don't think it's ever one really piece driving it. And I think one of the biggest things is the part that you hit on, is these are generally bigger, harder problems to solve. And sometimes they're harder to solve and harder to make a dent in just 2 weeks within a sprint. So you have to keep really looking at that and trying to decide how you're going to tackle that next little bit. And that leads me to another anti-pattern that I see a lot, is people try and tackle too much when they come out of a retrospective. They have this list of 10 things, and they just... that's unrealistic to expect to make a dent in that at all, right? So I really try and get teams to focus on 1, 2, tops 3 things, depending on the size of how are we going to get better.
I would agree with you. Dilution is probably, that's a good anti-pattern to bring up, because I think folks, so your youthful enthusiasm gets in your way sometimes, and you try to attack too many things, and it just dilutes you, particularly in narrower sprints. And it's not that you don't make any progress, but it's really hard to measure it, right? Mm-hmm. So it's demonstrable progress from one, you know, from one sprint end to the next sprint end, like a 2-week period. So taking less on would be an important thing. Maybe voting and doing more prioritization in the team is a way to really handle that. I think that Scrum Masters play a part in this, in that they get lackadaisical too. I know I've seen this in myself, where you go into a room, you do the 3 questions, you collect data, You rank order the data, and then you sort of close, right? And then you do it again and again and again. I think, so, yes, you want the team to do it. So now I'm going to sound like I'm disagreeing with myself. So you want the team to do it. But I think Scrum Masters, not so much functional managers, and not so much product owners, but Scrum Masters can play a part in keeping the team's eye on the ball, right? And really reminding them sort of in a healthy way. And that's probably, I've seen myself fall down on that as well.
Right.
I think it's one of those hard bits. Right. It's improvement is one of those hard things.
Yeah, I think, to me, one of the roles of the Scrum Masters is to not let them come out of that room until they have a plan of how they're going to tackle one of those things. So we don't stop at, okay, these are our top three, break. You know, everybody goes back to their day job. We try and spend the bulk of the time after the questions and trying to figure out what we're actually going to do about this.
Yep.
Because that... it does 2 things. It starts to get the buy-in and the investment and people thinking about what they're going to do, but it also gives us a real chance to actually make a difference, because there's so many times where, just like you said, people go in a room, they answer the questions, they rank them, and away they go. And it's hard for teams to grasp, right? So we actually try and spend that actually grooming the problem, and even sometimes building out a task list that we're going to throw up on our board.
See, I like that idea. Like that. I don't do... this is a wake up call for me. So this is a good metacast for me. It is, because I think I've gotten complacent in the power of the retrospective mm-hmm. and changing things up enough. And I think part of it is changing things up. I love your idea of planning, prioritization, game planning, right? Mm-hmm. And doing something like that. And I don't do that often enough.
I mean, we just ran into the same problems where we would go through those actions and people would buy into it, but we would get into the sprint and things became more important than our retrospective items. So what we ended up doing was putting them in our plan and putting them on our task board.
Yep.
So we can't win the sprint if we don't get those things
yep.
done. So it also forces the team to take a real look at what can we really get done.
And not try to
bite off way too much. Because, oh, by the way, we have a sprint we have to do. So these are things that we have to do in line with keeping our velocity up or even potentially helping it grow.
Yeah.
So that's...
I mean, I haven't been an active Scrum Master for a little while. I think when I was, now that I'm thinking back, I would do some more planning like that. Not so much planning in the retrospective, but taking those lessons into sprint... So taking that stuff into sprint planning
right.
is a wonderful opportunity to do that, and I would do that. And then into the activities of a sprint. And reminding folks, so independent of writing things down, bringing it into your, like, your planning artifacts, into your execution artifacts. What about taking the easy? I think of another adding pattern that I've seen of what I think of as taking the easy road. So teams that, you know, there's that notion of an 800-pound gorilla, and they don't put the 800-pound gorilla on the table. So they, in their retrospective, they're talking about easy things. They're mm-hmm. talking about palatable things, friendly things. Slight improvement things, but they're ignoring something like, let's say Sally's on the team and Sally is incredibly disruptive and doesn't take work on. And in the retrospective, no one says anything about that whatsoever.
Right.
Right. That's a contrived example, but...
No, but it's a very real example.
Right. But they're not getting into meaty issues in the retrospective. I've seen that quite often, and it affects the results because they're not attacking the meaty issues, they're not really improving.
Right.
Because they're not getting the root cause. Have you seen that pattern? And what are some ways, I wondered, to attack that?
Yeah. Absolutely, right. So as a manager, I end up hearing about those things first. So one of my first questions is, has it come up in a retrospective? Like, what are you guys doing about it? And those kind of issues that venture into the HR world kind of get hairy and people get very uncomfortable with them and they don't want to be the bad guy or whatever, right? Those are the big problems. But I think what you have to do is you have to start looking at the problems, and then as you dig into that, what I get the folks to try and do is drive towards what the real answer is. So not everybody's pulling their weight, so try and drive towards that without maybe jumping out and saying it and pointing a finger and saying, Sally, you know, you're what's wrong with this team. You know, that's not going to work. But trying to really dig into those meaty issues and trying to find the underlying cause. And that's, teams struggle with that just because of personal issues and things like that.
One of the things that I'm thinking about is, I was thinking about this book, I forget her last name. Diana is the one author's first name, and then Esther Derby is the second, and they wrote this book on retrospectives. And I read it a long time ago, and it had some sort of techniques in there, or sort of tools and techniques that you could use. But one of them was establishing norms. And again, I've been, now that I'm listening to this metacast, I'm thinking of things that, there are things that I've dropped the ball on as an agile coach, and one of them is sort of the power of the retrospective,
mm-hmm.
or setting it up, I guess. And part of it is setting it up for norms, like setting the stage where people can confront each other like that, asking permission of the team. You know what I mean? Not at an individual retrospective, but when you're forming the team,
mm-hmm.
you can talk about, hey, are we gonna like challenge each other in a healthy way? Our confrontation is going to be non-personal, but really reflected on the work, etc. And if you set the stage well, and they talk about that, even introducing people, you know, another technique they have is every once in a while having, you know, when you start up a team, is having people introduce themselves, talk about things that other folks don't know,
right.
you know, or challenges in their life or something. Yeah, I hope I'm making sense, but sharing challenges
yeah.
and getting more personal so that folks on the team know, you know, Bob has an aging grandmother, and that may be why he's working at odd hours and things like
right,
that.
Right, but doesn't that make it even harder to... confront somebody?
I think you're setting up not so much harder. You're trying to understand the nuance, and to not so much confront. Confront's the wrong word. But if Bob, you know, maybe me, if I have an ill grandmother, I should be taking on different work assignments.
Right.
Right. So there's constructive ways, not so much to confront me, but to help me.
Well, but it has to get to a point where, you know, I could say, Bob, what's going on? Right. So you were doing this and now you're doing this. And you and I should be able to have that discussion. And that's a confrontation from a lot of people's view, just even asking somebody, saying, hey, what's going on? Why aren't you doing what you've always done?
But there's a way of doing it, and what I'm paraphrasing it badly, but there's a way of doing it as a team where you expose, where you make people vulnerable as a group.
Okay.
And where they share things as a group. You still have quote-unquote confrontation, I think, but maybe little c confrontation.
Right.
It's not, and it's within the context of what's happening in the group. So, you know, for example, last week one of our team members became very gravely ill with a surprise infection or something like that, and we weren't sure what was going to happen with them. And clearly it affected the team, but it was also, even now as they come back to work, we're a little bit worried about, you know, how much focus they're going to have, and we don't want to overwork them so that they can find themselves ill again. And I think some of that exposure can help. But again, you want to confront. If it's affecting the team, you want to have this ability to foster an environment where folks can say truth.
Right.
I was talking about this. You want to be able to tell the truth that's happening in the team, not hide the truth.
Right? Yeah, you have to be able to be honest and receive honest feedback. And if your team can't do that, nothing in a retrospective is going to fix that.
No, it's like that tell truth. Maybe it's even, you know, going around the team in the beginning of the session and reminding everyone. And I'm trying to talk about setting the stage, which is something they did a good job of making folks feel like they can do it. So one of the things, I don't attend retrospectives. I've told you that before. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to create a safe environment so folks can say what needs to be said.
Right.
So they're not going to be influenced by me. We don't have managers there. So managers, the one meeting that managers aren't allowed at in our company is the retrospective, to sort of foster the safe environment. But in the same way, the team needs to foster a safe environment,
exactly.
For themselves.
Right.
So that they can say truth, or that they can tell truth.
Right. And so I think some of the ways I've seen people try and tackle that issue is have a published set of ground rules, right, going into the retrospective, of even like on a sheet of paper that sits in the middle of the table, that like you can slide that over to somebody if they're breaking, or like, hey, you know, remember these. You know, so that's something that I've seen folks use to help set that stage, like you were talking about, and then provide a way to direct people.
I've seen Scrum Masters, sometimes they can pretend, they can role play, or they can bring something that they're observing to play. So they, in their role, can throw an 800-pound gorilla on the table, mm-hmm. sort of in an indirect way, and just put themselves out there. And say, do you guys observe this or not? What are you seeing? Anonymous feedback is another way of gathering feedback before the retrospective. It's really hard to be anonymous in the retrospective with the card, you know, handwriting analysis and things like that. It's really hard to be truly anonymous. But you can gather anonymous feedback before the retrospective to try to, you know, I think a lot of things we're talking about now is, and I think they're really important, is getting it out there, getting that communication out there and that feedback out there.
So if your team needs anonymous feedback and that's the only way they feel comfortable, to me that feels like a team that's going to struggle over the long haul. Or do you think you can succeed? Or do you think there are just some things that's the way teams are going to handle it?
I think it's some things, I don't know. My initial reaction, I think I understand your question, is I think feedback rules. So I think no matter how, now there's different ways to get it. There's healthier ways to get it.
Right.
If I suck and you look me in the eye and say, Bob, you suck, I'd rather have you looking me in the eye and get it rather than get a postcard from you at Christmas. And in the fine print on the back, it says, Bob, I thought about it and you suck, right? Right.
Is it Christmas yet?
I might not even see that feedback. And I, you know, but you sent it to me, right? You did give it to me. I may not have just recognized it.
Yeah.
But I think all kinds of feedback are sort of good. We just tried this. We do a release retrospective. So this leads into different levels of retrospectives. I think there's team. In Agile, it's very focused on the team. And I probably said this again before at the Metacast, but we do a release retrospective. At the end of a release sequence, we get all of our stakeholders in a room. and we do the cards and things like mm-hmm. that. And due to scale, to the size of our team, our company's growing, we ran out of bandwidth to being able to do this in an hour,
right.
in a time-boxed hour. So we just started doing a survey with anonymous feedback. And that seeds the retrospective. So we gather anonymous feedback, and instead of gathering cards in the retrospective, we talk about the survey results.
Right.
But what we found is we got a lot of weird, you know, I guess, you know, so hard feedback to gather. You know, mm-hmm. so one of it was, like, Harry should be fired as right, as this role. So anonymity does promote boldness and
yes,
clarity.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
But and then we were exposing this feedback to the entire group, and folks were really concerned about that. Our testers were concerned. People were slamming test a little bit. Testers are an easy target, actually, and they shouldn't be. But they were slamming testers, and they were getting concerned about the perception that was in the retrospective. And from my point of view, I was trying to amplify, the power of us getting. I think the power, we can fight against the perceptions, and that's a minor nit compared to the open-mindedness and the power of doing a really good retrospective and handling feedback the way
right.
we do. And I've gotten great feedback from our senior leadership team around how we handle that.
Mm-hmm.
But anonymity is the team, you're going to get stuff that is harder to handle.
Yeah.
Right, as a facilitator.
At a release level, things just naturally become harder to handle.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, and some of it, so for every one of those, we probably got five really wonderful comments, right? And some of it was great. So a lot of it was great kudos for the team. I'm a firm believer in getting the feedback, though. But I think the key I'm saying here is, you can do surveys. There's different tools to gather it, depending on size. But get the feedback. Retrospectives are about getting that cyclical feedback. Any other patterns that you can think about?
I don't know that it's an anti-pattern. I just wanted to ask your question, or ask you a question. In those anonymous or in a release level retrospectives, it's... it feels like there's times where people are seeing so much negative stuff go up, because that's always like the first gut reaction, that where we struggle is really recognizing the good. People end up just throwing good up there, just kind of, they want to offset it, and they want to see that level kind of balance out a little bit. But I seem to struggle with folks giving more solid feedback on the good side than on the bad side, because they're so invested in the bad and it's hurt for so long or whatever, and this is their chance to speak out. But you don't get that same thing, and so then what I find that breeds is people have a short memory of how good things are and how things are getting better, because they get so focused on the bad parts.
I think I'd put that out, to your point, like a guideline. I think human nature, I know my human, I'll pick on me, my human nature...
Can I do that too?
Yeah, you can. My human nature is to think about, I'm thinking constructively, so I'm thinking of quote-unquote bad things.
Right.
And I think more deeply about bad things than I think about good things. Shame on me, I shouldn't do that. But that's sort of my tendency. So now I think maybe as part of guidelines up front, we can just identify that
right.
don't take it personal.
Yeah.
Now the other thing I've noticed in our release retrospectives is, so we present, the way we do our retrospective, we talk about the last release, like what were our agreements from the last time, what were our major themes
right.
from the last time, and then what do we think we've corrected. So the first time we did it, it was 80% bad, 20% and detailed bad, to
right.
your point, 20% not detailed good, frivolous good, and very few tries, if you use the
right,
good
yeah.
bad try model. Now that we're cyclically doing it, our bads turn into goods when we're effective
mm-hmm.
with making adjustments. And that's actually happening to us a lot.
Right.
So we're getting much more balance. We're probably like 50-50 from the good to bad, and then we're getting more increased tries as
right.
well. I think if you run it cyclically, where actually people are noticing, like last time, we functional coverage testing, we had some escapes in this particular area,
mm-hmm.
and the next time it might be a team. So right. we might have called out a team, if you will, and said Team Blarg had some real quality issues last time. Well, then the next time we'd look at, oh, Team Blarg had zero escapes.
Right.
So that naturally, not just me, I mean, someone
yeah.
would call that out. It becomes obvious because it was a bad.
Yeah.
And because we really worked so hard to improve, or that team worked so hard to improve.
Right.
So I think if you have a cyclical nature, it might wash that out a little bit.
Yeah.
That's what I've noticed.
Yeah, the biggest thing that what I'm trying to get at is trying to get the team to celebrate what they did well, because sometimes looking at the retrospective, they only see the bad, right? So it's like the news. You only see and you hear about the bad, and then people start to get focused on that. And like, well, we aren't good because look at all these things that are the bad.
I think it's a leadership role, too, and yeah. I think that's probably what you do. I think there's human nature. I think our human nature is to focus on that constructive criticism. In a review, we do that very often and stuff. And I think it's jobs for you, like you and I and the Scrum Master and the product owner, to amplify what we're good at. You're right.
Yeah.
It's probably not, you're not going to get that balanced nuance in, always in a retrospective.
Right. And I want people to focus on what they can do to get better, but I also want them to see, yeah, they are a good team, and they are doing well, and they are getting better.
But there's ways you can, we do that, we manage our trend. We celebrate the improvements before we get into the retrospective, like what did we do, what did we observe last time, and then what did we observe this time, sort of from a, you know, a soapbox perspective for 5 minutes or so, and we talk about some of those major trends. We always hit our big ones. Right. It's, we always have a fundamentally different shift. Now, remember, this is not 2 weeks. This is a release sequence, so this might be 8 weeks. And that gives you a significant chunk of time to what? To affect improvement.
Right.
And then you just celebrate that. But you're right. I think you have to be careful that the team doesn't feel piled on.
Right.
That is a sign. In the team, actually individuals, I'm sure if you bring that down to the micro aspects of a team, like individuals feeling piled on as well. And you shouldn't do that as a facilitator. What else on retrospectives? I'm trying to think, you know, other aspects. So do them, avoid some of the anti-patterns we were talking about, would be keys. Regularly do them. One of the things I think is shake it up.
Yeah,
try definitely. Different things. Yeah. So get away from your old patterns. Here's something I've done actually is have, you know, you can have people just do appreciations. I've seen this. So go into a retrospective, not so much at a release level, but at a team level, and have people just talk about what everyone's good at.
Right.
So have team members appreciate, talk about what they appreciate from other team members, and don't get into the good, the bad, and the ugly, right, or the try. Do that every other sprint.
Yeah, there's a ton of ideas out there because people do struggle with this. So you search on the web or Google, or there's books, right? There's tons of options out there to help you and your team get better at this.
Well, I think that Derby and Diana, I wish, I'm blanking on her last name. I have her face pictured in my mind, but I can't remember
Rothman?
Her. No, it's not Rothman. But it's Esther Derby. If you look up a book, it's Agile Retrospectives by Esther Derby and a co-author, Diane something or other. But no, it's an incredibly...
We're sorry, Diane.
Yeah, sorry. It's an incredibly good book that talks about a lot of techniques, I think, for shaking things up and getting feedback. It talks about setting agendas. It talks about, there's a technique in there called a timeline, where if you're doing, and we should do this in our release retrospectives. What happens in our release retrospectives is because it's 8 weeks or 10 weeks, people focus on the last 2 weeks.
Yeah.
They focus on the last 2 days of a sprint. And timeline says that you put a timeline for the interval that you're retrospecting, and you ask people to put ideas or notes along the whole timeline. And what it does is it mines a more broad set of ideas. People then remember the beginning, right?
Yeah.
And they remember things in the beginning. And that's a typical reaction no matter what the retro length is. So some ideas out there. I think from our point of view, just do it, right? Maybe that Nike thing.
Do it and have the same continuous improvement drive that you ask your teams to do, have that same thing about the retrospectives. Well, don't let it get stale.
Well, the thing I'm taking away from this is I've not, and again, continuous improvement, I've gotten a little bit complacent in my retros. I need to go back. I need to read the book. I need to sharpen myself up and my teams a little bit. I need to sharpen myself up in my coaching because I've fallen into that trap of the blind three questions or one approach for attacking the 800-pound gorillas, and there can't be one approach for attacking that. Good topic. I want to thank the listener for suggesting that. I think Josh and I have run out of time.
Yep, we have. So that's it for us for this.
Yet another Metacast. I don't know what number it is.
I don't know. We're in the middle teens here. Yeah. We're teenagers right now.
We are teenagers.
Yeah, so we have to start to figure some real-life answers out for who we are and what we're becoming.
So you can always find the Metacast at?
Metacast.com with a hyphen in the middle, and on Twitter at Meta-Cast, all spelled out. That's where you'll find us. We look forward for your feedback and hope you enjoyed the show.
Yep, give us some topics then. So everyone take care from beautiful downtown Cary, North Carolina. This is Bob Galen.
And Josh Anderson.
Shake
and bake.